Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
To say Donald Trump is obsessed with immigrants would be an epic understatement. From the moment he rode down the escalator at Trump Tower to announce his 2016 presidential campaign, through his 2024 bid to reclaim the White House, the Donald hasn't hidden his racism and bigotry and devotion to white nationalism. As he prepares to take office a second time on January 20th, God help us, Trump is vowing to carry out the largest mass deportation in American history, roundups that could snag U.S. citizens, too, and separate families. Those who have citizenship can stay. Those who don't get the boot. He even wants to eliminate birthright citizenship. Not surprisingly, Trump's bluster and threats are having a chilling effect on the estimated 90,000 undocumented immigrants living in Oklahoma. For this week's ObserverCast, Norman Representative Annie Menz, a member of the Oklahoma Legislature's Latino Caucus, joins us for a deep dive into the implications and potential repercussions of Trump's plans on immigrants living in Oklahoma, on law enforcement, on businesses, and on communities.
Representative Menz, we're so glad to have you here today, but go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself, the district that you represent, and what you do.
Well, thank you. And thank you all for having me again. It's always a pleasure to visit with friends at The Observer. So I'm excited to be here. I am State Representative Annie Menz. I represent East Norman in House District 45. I am the first Latina elected to the Oklahoma House of Representatives in state history and am a member of the Oklahoma Legislative Latino Caucus. I'm also the founder of the Hispanic Cultural Day at the Capitol that we do every year. The format was different this year, but we do that event every year, and it's a pretty good turnout and very important for us to do. So I was really excited to be able to have a hand in starting that and to keep it going. And so just kind of those are the kind of things on topic that I wanted to share with y'all. So I'm really excited to have this conversation.
So with the lead up to the presidential election last month, we, of course, saw, the banging of the xenophobia drums and the anti-immigrant rhetoric really, really ratcheted up, like I'd say abnormally high, right? Like it was, I mean, we have Stephen Miller coming out of the woodworks again. We've got just all the worst of the worst, border czars, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, Trump gets elected to a second term. I've talked about this many times in this podcast, and I'm just going to bring it up, but literally the opening words of my dissertation are, the border of Oklahoma is 500 miles from the border of Mexico, and yet immigration is still an issue here, right? Politicians have still used it as kind of a bludgeon to get, terrible things through the House and the Senate, at the expense of the immigrants that live here. Can you talk about a little bit about what you've seen and what you've experienced, kind of the lead up to the election? Because that month to 6 weeks before those November elections was pretty heated, right? Like it wasn't just like immigration just kind of popped up out of nowhere. We saw, immigrants used as a scapegoat for months in this election. So can you talk a little bit about that and then, how that really kind of shapes the immigrant experience from your perspective?
Sure. Yeah. And so that's a really good question. There definitely was a noticeable ramp up in the kind of hateful rhetoric that we'd seen coming not only, from the national stage, but locally here too. It filters down to Oklahoma oftentimes first before any other states, where, right. Yeah, we're kind of like testing ground for some.
We are a laboratory for all the worst things that mm-hmm. happen on the national stage, like time. And
right.
Time.
It mm-hmm. happens here first. So
this people pay attention to us for that, but whatever,
Right. And so we definitely saw a lot of that coming. We knew So whenever I say we in this answer, I'm talking about the Latino caucus. So at that point was 5 members deep, well, four, I say. So it was, me, Rep. Alonzo Sandoval, Senator Brooks, Senator Garvin, and Representative Ryan Martinez. So Representative Martinez had resigned. So then there were 4 of us left during this last session. And we know that in election years, there are bills filed and run through legislative session that are hot button issue bills that help other people, get reelected and give them talking points out on the campaign trail and all of that. So that a little bit of that was to be expected. But when we saw some of the things that were filed, it was just some of the most immoral bills that I have seen in a very long time targeted toward immigrant community, and some of which would affect everyone. I mean, not even not just, I mean, the intended like target was the immigrant community, specifically undocumented immigrants, but the unintended consequences of some of these bills would have bad effects on everyone, citizens, undocumented people, everyone. And so for us to be able to have a cohesive Latino caucus that gets together, and meets regularly and has regular events and things, and we now have a PAC operation, it was really important for us to be able to sort of have like a defensive front. I mentioned earlier that I started the Hispanic Cultural Day at the Capitol many years ago, and it was always just this fun event where we kind of invite the community into the Capitol to meet their legislators and invite the legislators down to enjoy our culture, the dancing, the food, the music. We have several nonprofit organizations that cater to the community, and the point was to showcase our culture and our community and the things that we're doing as Oklahomans, because there is a Latino community in every House district and every Senate district across the state. And so just to kind of build that relationship and make ourselves available for any kind of question and support that we might be able to give, and just kind of build a good relationship. This year, we had to change the format because there was a terrible bill that was passed. The governor had signed it, and we had maybe like 10 days to decide. We had already had everything in the works for Hispanic Cultural Day. Once the governor signed that bill, we started receiving calls. The caucus started receiving calls from our vendors and from the performers saying that they did not want to participate anymore. They were either too afraid to come to the Capitol, or they were rightfully upset and they didn't want to share their culture with these people, because we tried to do it nice. We tried to do it the nice way for many years, and it was like, it felt like, what was it for if they were just going to put us all in the same box and label us something that we're not criminals, something that we're not. And we're still going to show up. Why would we show up and share our culture and share our smiles with them? So we had 10 days to flip the format. It became a rally. It was attended by thousands of people. There were people who chartered buses from Tulsa and from like the Guymon area that came down for it. That's something that I've been trying to get in the works for the regular Hispanic Cultural Day, just to have people from around the state come to attend it. So in that, I think lies a little bit of a silver lining in that it has given us something to rally around to bring us together even more. And just touching back to what you were saying about the national stage, I think we've seen the power of the Latino vote play out nationally in places. And I'm not one for saying I told you so to people, but I have been saying for many years that we cannot, specifically in the Democratic Party, sleep on the Latino vote. It's important. And I mean, here we are. So
And it's not necessarily democratic, because I think what we learned was a huge lesson from the from this past election, right? Like, we can't we should not write off Latino votes as democratic votes.
Right. Right.
So,
Like, you
yes.
can't just like bank on them to be to vote for the Democrat because the Republican is racist. Like, if you know, like, I
Right.
don't think, like, I had an opportunity recently to visit with some of my legislator friends in other states, a lot of whom are of Puerto Rican descent. And they said, you know, after we heard about the floating trash island or whatever, literally none of us were surprised. That's not the first time we've been insulted. We've come, I mean, West Side Story, we've come to this country and have been faced with insults ever since. So that's not something that is real, that was really going to sway anybody's vote. So saying vote for us because the other guy's racist doesn't really say much anymore.
So, I guess one of the reasons we definitely wanted to have this conversation now, with the new administration coming in on January the 20th, is to hopefully get a sense from you, where that leaves folks in Oklahoma who are members of the Latino community. And there are estimates that somewhere in the neighborhood of what 90,000 are undocumented in Oklahoma, and there are many more beyond that. And when you think about some of the policies that Donald Trump has proposed, you could end up even with American citizen family members being removed from this country. And rights being stripped away from those who were born to undocumented parents. And it seems to me, I mean, that's got to create a fair amount of angst about how you proceed. What do you do? How do you make plans for something that may or may not happen?
Right. So I'm glad that you asked that. This gives me a really great opportunity to talk specifically about why I've joined you today. Because I mean, I'm sure that we can get together and talk about where things went wrong and how horrified we all are, and how afraid we are for our friends and our neighbors and our undocumented neighbors. But there are things that we can do. But to tell you about that, I have to tell you a little story first about where how we got this. So I believe it was during the first Trump administration, and I could be wrong about that, but there was a like a meat processing plant or meat packing plant in one of the southern states, Mississippi, something. And the people who largely the people who worked there were undocumented. So one day during the week, they get up, they take their kids to school, and they go to work. And in the middle of their workday, there was an ICE raid, and they were all detained for an undetermined amount of time, some of them deported. And the kids were left at school for the entire weekend because there was no legal guardian to pick them up. So the teachers, the administrators, you know, the district officials, they were there basically watching these kids as they slept in the gym, the hallways, watching other people's kids because they couldn't legally release them to anyone because their parents had been deported. So you just have this school full of scared, hungry children, because somebody wanted to raid a plant where they knew a lot of undocumented people worked. To, I don't know, make themselves feel better, like they did something. So out of that came a conversation with Senator Brooks several years ago, when I worked for him in his Senate office. We filed what's called standby guardianship, and it was passed and signed into law this year. That was Senate Bill 1701. So this law makes it easier for parents to designate a trusted guardian for their children in case of emergencies, like illness, detention, deportation, deployment. The process is streamlined, so it would allow parents to protect their children with a straightforward written designation that they have prepared by an attorney. Alongside things like standby guardianship, we are also encouraging families to complete powers of attorney, which would allow, in their absence, someone designated to make financial or medical decisions on their behalf. So when we have cases where parents are abruptly deported, it would that is what's called a triggering event, and it would trigger the standby guardianship. So if I have a relative who is undocumented and they ask me to be their standby guardian for their child, and they were deported abruptly in the middle of the day, it would fall to me, and my response it would be my responsibility to assume guardianship of their child until they can be reunited. So we received bipartisan support for this because it doesn't just pertain to deportation, that it covers other triggering events. But that one, just with the way that we know President Trump is intending to operate, that's something that was more of a preventative measure, and something that I think, now that we know what's going to happen more or less, instead of setting our hair on fire, we can take the anxiety that we feel, and channel it towards something like this, which is more empowering and it can help us give people some kind of peace of mind, about their kids, their families. And some hope, because it's going to get worse. Things are going to get worse before they get better. But being able to go in and educate people about things like this is vitally important right now, whenever we're trying to calm them down or give them a peace of mind. Like, there are things that we can do. Not all is lost.
So,
So, well, I was just going to say a lot of, this, first of all, a lot of people may not be aware that this is available to them, for an emergency circumstance. But for a lot of folks who are, trying to keep the roof over their heads and are, working long, arduous jobs and more than one jobs in some cases, is there an affordability issue here? What sorts of things are being done to, in terms of outreach to let people know that this is available to them as sort of an ultimate protection for their kids, for example?
so that's where it gets a little bit tricky, because if we are too wide in our awareness campaign on this, we'll end up with the wrong kinds of responses from the people who would see it destroyed or taken away. So this is a new thing. So, I mean, people don't know about it yet. We're, as a caucus, starting working it into gear with education on what it even is, what is standby guardianship, what is a power of attorney. And that is going to happen largely in Spanish media, for the time being. So just that's something that we're trying to do. But I know that we're going to be working, in partnership with several community leaders, as well as organizations like ACLU, to be able to spread the awareness and make sure that if there's funding necessary, that funding will be available. Should we decide to do any kind of like legal clinic or anything like that? So right now we're in the education stage, because you're right. I mean, not a lot of people know about it because it was just signed into law this year.
Would people be afraid to even participate in things like that, though? Worried that, if they sort of raise their head out of the foxhole, in public, that there might be certain folks sort of lying in wait to snag them and haul them off?
Yeah, I think that people would be afraid of that, yes. So that's
Oh my gosh. Okay.
challenging.
I think about that, and I just think of the kind of comprehensive chilling effect, that we're going to see in terms of members of the, Latino community, the immigrant community in general. I'm just thinking of picking up your kids from school,
Right.
showing up at the school to pick up your kid, to drop them off, showing up to any workplace, just going to the grocery store.
Right.
All the ways where, you're suddenly very vulnerable because you're in public in any capacity. And I feel like an important thing to mention is that there's not like some, Geiger counter for immigration status that they can like stick out and determine who's documented and who's not.
Not without violating people's
Right.
civil
I mean, you
rights.
can't just like look at somebody and be like, oh,
Right.
right.
Yeah.
That person is documented. That one, I don't think so. So we're gonna haul them in, right? There is no actual discernment.
There's no discernment and there's no way to go about doing that without violating people's civil rights. And,
And I mean,
like,
and this is a historical fact, right? Like
yes, it's
this
not a
is
matter of opinion. These are things that have
right.
happened,
I
they've been
mean, I have books.
litigated.
Right. I have books
Yeah.
in the cabinet next to me, documenting exactly this, right?
Yes.
Like everyone gets swept up in these maneuvers, not just
Right.
one immigration status or the other.
Right. And then whenever you think about, just culturally speaking too, I mean, if they're trying to target a certain group of immigrants, which, we know they are,
How do you do that? But yeah,
well, we don't all look the same. So I mean, there are, I know I have plenty of, friends who are members of the Cherokee Nation, Choctaw Nation, Chickasaw Nation, who have been mistaken for Latino, and they are 0% Latino. I have 0%. And I have also Latino friends who are Black, who are blonde hair, blue eyes. I mean, who grew up in Mexico. I mean, so you cannot, there is no logical way to just sniff out who you think, might be here undocumented. Without violating people's rights. You just
So
can't do it.
it's merely by association, right? Or by
Right.
assumption. But the that does nothing to minimize the actual harm and threat that will cause.
Right. Because what we ended up with a lot of folk here in the legislature who evidently just don't care that that's the reality. Like, we know that doing this will violate people's civil rights. Law enforcement organizations in the state came out against it for that very reason. They do not want to be put in the position of having to make that call because how, because they don't know how, I mean, you can't. But the legislature enacted it anyway. So that tells me that they know that there are going to be US citizens locked up because they were mistaken for somebody else, and they don't care.
Because it's not about citizenship, right? It's not about
No.
citizenship. It's about race. I mean, and I'll say that as a white lady, right? Like, I mean, because there is no actual way to identify someone's citizenship status, residency status, like just by visually looking at somebody. It's all a guess.
Right.
And I mean, history shows. We have documentation of this. We have a historical record for when this has happened in the past, because it has happened in the past. It has happened multiple times in the past. It happens like, oh, it happens like clockwork, right?
Yeah.
Anytime there's some perception of economic threat, immigrants are the brunt of it. Period. Again,
Yeah,
I
you
can't.
notice how it's never the billionaires.
Right. I mean, we're not worried about them, right? But we're worried about people who are actually doing the work to put food on your table, to put the roof on your house, to mow your lawn. I mean, all the stuff that folks don't want to do. Like we're gonna go after those folks. But I'm just like thinking through like the cascade of ways this is going to harm, commerce and the economy, right? So and just kind of remembering from my field work during my dissertation, just the how immigrants won't bank anymore because of the fear, and then that puts them vulnerable to, burglary, basically people coming in, like breaking into their homes because they know the money's there, right? And just but
And
like,
it also has a negative impact on the banking industry
yeah.
too.
Yeah, if you don't have that capital, right? Like you don't have that liquidity. So there's that. But then just like the commerce and the businesses in these communities, right? If people are too afraid to leave their homes, are they going to get groceries? Are they going to get the items that they need? They're certainly not going to get health care.
Also, we'll see an uptick in, I mean, it's a public safety issue. For, the reasons that you mentioned as well, but if you're undocumented and you're experiencing trafficking or domestic violence, you're less likely to call the authorities because, so I mean, those numbers are going to tick up as
So
a result of bills
even
like
if you
this.
do have your home broken into, you're probably not going to call.
Not going to call the police.
I
So,
mean,
yeah, they haven't done anything to actually slow or stop illegal immigration. What they've done is just made the state less safe for all of us.
And then there's going to be all the work that's going to be left undone, right? So.
But like I said, not all is lost. There are still ways that we can go in and help people. I know that it's going to be scary going to the grocery store or dropping your kids off. I know that it's going to be scary, getting pulled over. But you should have that kind of peace of mind, at least that your kid's going to be taken care of if the worst happens and you are taken from them, that there's a chance that you'll see them again if you did the backup and you did what you were supposed to do in the midst of all of this. And I mean, that's something that we can at least have going forward to help people feel some kind of prepared.
As a state legislator, though, your hands are tied in many ways, it seems to me, because this is such a overridingly federal issue. There are limits, it seems to me, to what you guys can do, although the legislation that you referred to on the standby guardianship obviously is significant. But so does that.
Yeah, so that goes back to my point about them not having actually done anything to stop illegal immigration or slow it. Because at the state level, we can't really do anything to stop it. It's a federal level thing. There are things that we can do at the state level to make sure that we're making the most of it, like ta driver's licenses for taxpayers so that we can identify people and reap the benefits of their taxpayer status. There are things that we can do that can be proactive, that isn't, it's not condoning breaking the law, but it's saying that we have a full grasp of the situation, and we understand it, and we are controlling it rather than this is out of control. Let's just shut the whole thing down, which we cannot do on the state level.
So why is there resistance on the driver's license thing? I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense, and I get the notion from, larger law enforcement agencies in Oklahoma that they think it's a great idea because, again, it really helps them do their jobs.
Yes, it's been endorsed by law enforcement several times, and Senator Brooks has filed it a few times. I think he's planning on filing it again, just because it's just a piece of very sound policy. We've heard a number of objections to it and different reasons. We address them, we fix it, then they come up with something else to complain about. At first, it was, well, they're going to use these to register to vote, which we all know can't happen. But we, in the bill, the way that it was written, there was already a provision in there that would keep that from happening, but we went ahead and we put two more provisions in the bill that just was suspenders and a belt, you know, just to say, look, here it is. We have several pages where we can point to a way in which we have put in a safeguard to keep that from happening. They will not be able to use these to register to vote. So, okay, now we're just saying, we're telling everyone it's okay, come to Oklahoma. Come to Oklahoma, you can have a driver's license here. Well, no, we're not doing that. We've tied it to taxpayer status. If you're already here and you've already been paying taxes, you would qualify. That's how that works. It's not inviting new people. I mean, there's always going to be a group of people who are going to throw something at it because they just don't like it, because they just don't like immigrants. That's it, whether they're legal or not, they don't like immigrants.
Well, and of course, my suspicion is that there are a lot of people out there who somehow equate immigrants to, you remember the old Ronald Reagan, welfare queen driving a Cadillac, stereotype, that somehow they're sucking the system dry and not contributing to it at all. But you go back, and I was looking up some of the numbers earlier, and you look back to the latest study that I saw from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy suggested that the undocumented folks in Oklahoma contributed $227.5 million in state and local taxes. And
That's right.
that doesn't include what they pay, of course, in Social Security or Medicare and that kind of thing. But and they can't draw on any of those benefits anyway. They can't draw on food stamps.
Right.
So they're net contributors in a sense, from a fiscal point of view. It's not like you could say, well, God, they're just, draining the taxpayers dry on this thing. I don't know. It's maddening and it's foolish, but clearly people think that there are people in positions of power who think that this is an electoral winner for them. And I'm afraid that November's general election nationally probably encouraged that thought process. So that may be just the beginning of what we're seeing, including, Kevin Stitt now saying he wants to take everybody, every undocumented person who's behind bars in Oklahoma and send them back to wherever they came from.
Right, and that becomes particularly murky when we think about the countries that we don't have those such agreements with, like how, like extradition agreements with. I think I'd heard maybe on a one of the podcasts I listened to, the NPR podcasts, about how our the incoming presidential administration wants to deport people to countries that they're not even from. Because if they're from a country that we don't have an agreement with, then where are they going to send them? Right? So they have to send them somewhere. We'll just send them out of the country and it doesn't matter. It's Mexico's problem or whoever. So again, not the most responsible way to go about this. It's a lot of it seems to me like a lot of emotional reactions. So, and like you said, it was something that was pretty prevalent in the election, and the results kind of showed us that this is something people care about. But I think that it was drawn out, and people's emotions were preyed on, about this. And it's just, I mean, you can tell people, you can give them that stat, right? And we have, the Latino Caucus has, we've said, 227.5 is a big number. If you want to talk about mass deportations, you should maybe have that much to write a check to the tax commission. Because that's a very expensive joke you just made. Mass deportations is a very, very expensive joke to make. When you confront them with the data and the reality, it's like they cannot hear it because they are so emotionally flooded by this that they have to win, they have to do these mass deportations, and suddenly they will feel better about something. It's about how they feel about themselves and about how they feel about our country. And that's what their platform is being run on. And that's just, you can't legislate feelings.
So where does that leave you in terms of, you don't, your comrades in the legislature are probably not very open to the idea of doing much to actually, help keep this from becoming a complete colossal nightmare. What are you left to do at this point, as a legislator? To try to make sure that folks' rights are protected, and that we don't have the kinds of scary things that we think we could see happening with certain law enforcement in the state.
Right. So, to continue to just, if we can't do anything legislatively, just to continue to be an advocate and to be a listener, as a legislator, and to be able to synthesize the voices, of our community and translate it and communicate it to our fellow legislators in a way that, is comprehensive and lets them know, hey, like this, these are humans. These are people who have been here and they're not going anywhere and they deserve dignity and respect. I feel like sometimes if my colleagues across the aisle don't understand something about my culture or just about my culture or my community, it's because I haven't explained it to them. So just to continue to provide that resource additionally, to my community to be there defending and be there so that they know that there's at least some people in that building who sees them and respects them and honors, their sacrifices and doesn't hate them and want them to die. Somebody that doesn't think that they're criminals and that they aren't worth being here because they are. And that's something, while it sounds floral, it's real. It translates into something real for our community, for them to know without a shadow of a doubt that they have advocates in that building.
It seems to me, and it maybe this is Pollyanna-ish, and so set me straight if you think I've lost my mind here, but it does seem to me that there would be some very powerful interests in this state who would be very supportive of finding ways to make sure that that the Latino community is protected, that rights are protected. That workers are able to continue to work. Also, I'm thinking of business owners. I'm thinking of, law enforcement that says, it's going to make it our job so much tougher. I just look all around and I think there are an awful lot of folks, influential folks in Oklahoma, who are reliant, who for whom it's very important that this not become, this
Right.
roundup and just a colossal mess.
Right. You're not wrong, actually. We Senator Brooks was able to build a coalition around the driver's license bill that he filed, and he's been able to sustain that coalition and add more people to it. And you're absolutely right. Business owners, bankers, insurance professionals, law enforcement, cattlemen, farmers, people who have workers. He at one point met with the people from Tyson in Arkansas because they were looking at doing similar legislation there. His legislation has kind of is serving as a model for some other states that have large immigrant populations and large undocumented workforces, right? Like our state does. There is a coalition, and people, I think, when you explain it to them as a matter of policy, it's great. It's understandable. It's these are the numbers, this is the money that we can bring in with this driver's license bill, this is why it's a good idea. Then you go to the cons list, and this is why it's a bad idea. And all of those cons are rooted in emotion and emotional reactions to what this is. Well, you're just condoning breaking the law by you're just rewarding them for breaking the law. And it's never mind the fact that this would make our roads safer, that it would generate revenue for law enforcement. This would generate revenue for law enforcement. It would generate revenue for the state. There are lots of practical, good reasons to do this, but it's always going to go back to the small few who are, they're not a silent majority. They're the minority and they're the loudest. But it's always going to go back to them, and it's always going to be an emotional response. And that's been the wall that we've been hitting so far, I think. But you're right. I mean, there are people, lots of people, in different industries and workforces across the state who would want to see this done, because it makes good economic sense.
But I also think there's this sense out there among a lot of Oklahomans that, somehow jobs are being stolen from, from actual citizens. Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean. I mean, people who that somehow, you've got a workforce here that, that's coming in and isn't being paid as well, and it's, and in many cases, maybe even being abused, and I just think there's sort of that general sense out there, but I know from personal experience and reporting that I've done over the years, particularly related to meat packing industry and so forth, that these are jobs by and large, oftentimes that only immigrant workers will take. That we, that Americans tend to be softies on these things and don't. I remember a guy, at a plant in the Texas Panhandle telling me that, he says, we have these young, strapping white guys who come in, and they, most of them don't last a day.
So I mean, sure, there's that aspect, but also, I mean, think about a small business owner who hires undocumented workers to do some of that labor, and it generates more work. They take on more work, so then they have to hire more workers, which would then mean that they need to hire somebody to process payroll, and they need to hire somebody to be their manager, and they need to hire somebody to do HR stuff or what have you. And so their company is growing, but those management, those professional positions, those are going to be filled by people who are citizens, people who are here that have been here. That's creating jobs. So when you have that as a, I mean, that could be an anecdotal thing. It could be a widespread thing. But if it could be any kind of thing, why wouldn't we want to take that opportunity? Why wouldn't we want to encourage job growth, even if it's on the back of illegal immigration? Which, I mean, again, we go back to the whole, well, you're just rewarding them for being here illegally. I mean, that's, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that or read it or seen it, plastered on someone's Facebook. It's not that we're rewarding, it's that we are taking control of the situation that the federal government has not taken control of. Because it does affect us. The border is very, very, very far away, but it does affect us. This is us saying, yes, we recognize it. We cannot stop it. So let's take control of it for ourselves, for Oklahoma. We don't need to defer to the federal government on some of it. We don't need to defer to the other states surrounding us on some of it. There are things that we can do here on the state level to take advantage of it and get it under control rather than just saying, nope, none of it. We don't want any of it, because that's not going to stop it. It's not going to do what they want to do.
You know, I, and I'm I don't know how else to ask it, but just as straightforwardly as I can. But
Sure.
where are groups that you would think this would resonate with, like the state chamber, like the Farm Bureau, people like that? Are they working to try to, as best you can tell, to come to some sort of happy median here and resolves it as best we can, given the state's limited stroke on the issues? Or are they do you find them feeling like somehow it's a radioactive issue because a lot of the membership might well be fueled by that fear that we have
Right.
encountered them?
So I fully trust that Senator Brooks will be working hard at building back that coalition. But there are some organizations who were on board and, they gave us their logo to put on our leave behinds about the bill. And they were, they took it to their organizations and they voted to support it. But then after things started to heat up on the political stage, nationally, and this started to become a bigger issue, because it's Trump's number one issue. They started to back off. I mean, they started to beg off of supporting because, like you said, their memberships were just not. I mean, they were fueled by that emotional response of why are we re rewarding criminal activity? But again, I fully trust that Senator Brooks will be working hard to maintain those connections and those relationships with those organizations. And has I mean he's gone into the belly of the beast to people to attend meetings in person. I mean, he's gone to an OK2A meeting in person to let them ask questions. I mean, he is relentless in this. This is something that he wants to see done, and there isn't anything that he wouldn't do to help people who need his help. And I fully believe that he's going to be, again, doing all that work to regain that support and gain more.
So do you think do you have any sense at all for sort of how undocumented folks in Oklahoma are navigating this right now? I could almost see because I'm really good at this, sticking my head in, being an ostrich and sticking my head in the sand. I mean, is there a lot of, I mean, do you get a sense that there's sort of a just putting one foot in front of the other and continuing to try to operate and we'll deal with it as it comes? Or do you get a sense that more and more people are saying, I don't know what to do here. How can I be more proactive?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that there's a mixture of both. There's some folks who are just like, well, I didn't get deported when Trump was president last time, so I'm sure I'll be fine this time, and I'm just taking it one day at a time. There are other people who are like, do I need to move to another state that is more friendly? We hope that they don't because they are part of the fabric of Oklahoma and part of our economy, and we would like to keep that here, but there's a mixture of responses, but I think overall for us as a caucus, just to be able to provide some empowerment to people individually, like to these families, that's kind of sort of our goal. So I know that there's some panic out there. There are people worried about filling out this form or filling out that form or, going about doing things the way that they did before the election, just kind of changing their way of life here just to kind of try and survive. We want to be able to give them hope and provide just a space for them to see themselves in their government and not just, again, people who hate them. And I say that, but I was remembering just a few seconds ago about how the reaction was with one of my colleagues from across the aisle. I won't say names, but I'd heard that he wasn't going to vote for the bill. He couldn't vote for it. And he said, quote, "Where I'm from, I can't vote for something like that because I'll get my ass kicked on Main Street, because of the large population, I guess, of undocumented immigrants in not only his town, but his district. It's rural. So I mean, I definitely don't want there to be any kind of like violence is never the answer. I don't want there to be any kind of even scent of condoning that kind of reaction. I haven't seen any like angry kind of retribution threatening things. It's mostly just like, how do I take care of my kids? How do I take care of my parents? Do we need to move? You know, that kind of thing. Just kind of logistically, okay, what are the next steps? And then there are others who are just thinking in terms of last time, like, oh well, you know, I was fine last time, I'll be fine this time, so I don't need to worry about it. Those are the ones I think I worry about most, because while I don't think they I don't I know I don't want them to panic and I don't want them to feel anxious every single day, but I also don't want them to become so complacent that they end up in trouble either. But it's, I don't know, it's like it's a mixture of responses, really.
Yeah, that's a balancing act, I would think. I don't know if I were in their shoes how I would not be consumed by it 24/7, and
Yeah.
you know, and concerned about what I should do. Should I leave? Should I stay? You know, how do we navigate this? It just you know, we haven't even talked, and this is really out of your purview too, but I'm, you know, we obviously have a lot of dreamers in Oklahoma, and I know some of them personally, and I guess I took some heart, you know, a little teeny bit of optimism from Trump's Meet the Press segment, where he indicated that he was willing to work with Democrats to find some way to, you know, to protect the dreamers. But it leaves me wondering, as we sort of wrap this up because of the time constraint, whether what things that those of us who recognize the value of this community to our fabric as a state, you know, whether it's culturally, economically, socially, you know, all those things, you know, what sorts of things would you encourage those of us to do to try to get your colleagues to be aware that there are a lot of folks, probably many more folks out there, who actually think that this is something that we can do some things to mitigate and make lives better for everybody here in Oklahoma.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you asked that, because that was the exact question that I asked in the Latino Caucus meeting that we had, about what we're doing, you know, going into the next session to try and put together an agenda, but also a plan to play defense still, and maybe make some offensive maneuvers here and there. But the one question I did ask was, you know, I'm going to be going on different, I'm going to be doing responses to media requests about this, because there are only three of us in the legislature now, and we're the ones most equipped to answer these questions, because we just are. And I want to be able to tell people, especially in my district, because I'm the only legislator in the Latino caucus who represents a district that isn't majority Latino. I have a lot of folks in my district who just care about other people. They just care about their neighbors. They don't want anyone to feel scared or frightened to be here. They want to help. So the number one thing I would say to do is make sure that you're following the Latino caucus on social media platforms, because we put out a lot of information and we do ask for help on things. And I know that we'll be asking for help on other things. We do political things, like we have candidates, we run political operations, but we also just stuff that we do in the legislature whenever it comes to spreading awareness about standby guardianship. We'll be putting that stuff out. When you see it, share it with people that you know. Just making sure that everyone knows, is equipped with the knowledge, and support your local Latino community leader who's out there doing this work and has likely been doing this work for many, many years, and knows their stuff. But yeah, I think just making sure that you're following the right folk and up to speed on what the efforts that are already ongoing, and be supportive of those if you can.
Well, now, based on your experience in the legislature, both on a staff level and as an elected official, do you think it's helpful for folks to say to be in contact, via a letter, or email, a phone call, whatever, with their legislators to say, we really need to find a way to make this work? And to be reasonable and sensible about this, because there are a lot of lives at stake, and really, what it says a lot about what kind of a state Oklahoma is or aspires to be, how we proceed in this. Is it the kind of thing that gets folks to sort of sit up and take notice and say, well, there is maybe another side to this than some of the loud clamoring that I'm hearing?
Yeah, and so yes, I would say that that is effective. But again, and that's not to sound too gatekeepy or anything, but the Latino Caucus has specific times whenever we need people to flood inboxes, and we put that out. And so we'll have opportunities that'll say, text this word to this number, to tell Governor Stitt not to sign the bill. And we put those blasts out and we flooded his inbox with, like, I think it was like 10,000 emails one day. Like, there are those opportunities, but again, making sure that you're following those social media accounts and paying attention to the ongoing efforts, I think, so that it would make the most impact at the right time. That's vital. That's a key piece.
So do you have some addresses that you would suggest people go to, or that you go to Facebook and type in Latino Caucus? Do you go on on a platform from X to Blue Sky to Threads or whatever, and search that way? How can people make that connection?
Sure. Yeah. So on Facebook, we are Oklahoma Legislative Latino Caucus. That is our official name. And so that's that. We predominantly are on Facebook because a lot, I mean, that's what the Latino community uses mostly, Facebook and WhatsApp. So we're on both of those. And I believe we're getting an Instagram setting up for this next session. Because more and more young Latinos are using Instagram as well. So those are the two. That's Facebook is really the main one, that you'll get quicker up to date things for the time being. But again, just keep an eye out, and we'll be letting people in on all kinds of things that we're going to be working on.
Fantastic. Well, you guys have your work cut out for you in the next session. I'm sure you said we could probably say that every session that we're heading into.
No kidding. Yeah, it's going to be a rough few years.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and it was a great conversation. And I just have a feeling that we're going to need to talk more about this in the months ahead. So I hope you'll be willing to share some time with us and moving forward, so we can keep people up to date on what's going on. Because I know there are a lot of folks out there who are very concerned about their Latino friends and neighbors
Yeah.
and family members, and this is, oh, it's going to be bumpy for sure.
Yes. So thank you. Again, it was my pleasure to join you. I would definitely be happy to do it again in the future. It's always such a pleasure visiting with you both, and also the in-person events at Full Circle. I always have a good time at those. So yeah, you know how to reach me anytime. Happy to do it.
We do. Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.